Thank you very much. Good morning. It's Feroz Patel from the Department of Higher Education and Training. Chairperson, I just needed your guidance. On the 8th of August 2012, at a portfolio committee meeting when the department tabled the bill, the committee in particular were on the section of the administrator in regards to the National Institute. Raised the issue that there was an alignment between that administrator in the National Institute and that's applicable to higher education institutions. And the chairperson had asked that the department think about the issue of administrators. And therefore, Chair, we did think about that. We do have a proposal, but we seek your guidance as to the appropriate time that you would want to take the input.
It could be better if we allow the department to actually make their input in relation to that, so that the people that are going to present can as well comment on it if they wish to do so. Then can we Anela wants to chair the meeting. I must allow the department to start the presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Advocate Boshoff from our Legal and Legislative Services will do the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the presentation is therefore focusing on possible new inclusions in the legislation for the committee to consider. It is a proposal which is made by the Minister as possible amendments which came as a result of position that was put to all in all the attendants in the meeting, including the Deputy Minister that was part of that meeting on that day. The approach that we've taken in this document that's now distributed is to bring the whole concept of the administrator in line with what we've had in the current bill, which is applicable to the independent assessor. The National Institutes for Higher Education, but it goes slightly beyond that. Because of the approach in the with the higher education institution of the independent assessor, and also the relationship with the independent assessor and their investigation and the impact that has on the appointment of the administrator. Chair, the approach that the minister is putting to the committee and to the public hearing is to provide for a number of new clauses that should be inserted into the current bill. So the document will refer to new clause 4, which would mean a new clause in the bill 23 of 2012, which is the bill dealing with higher education and training laws amendment. This introduction of the new clause 4 is to amend the current section 41 capital A current situation dealing with the administrator, and it is moved to the section or the chapter of the Act where it deals with the independent assessor and also the administrator to follow that, and not as a hooked on position that is provided in the chapter dealing more with the funding and administration. What we are doing there is to propose that subsections 1 and 2 be repealed, because it will be dealt with in a more elaborate way in the proposed new section, which is dealing with the new sections of section 49, capital B, and up to capital 49, capital E. The next one is to deal with amendments. That's the new clause 5, which is dealing with the independent assessor's investigation, which is a very important basis for the appointment of an administrator. And we have seen that there is a direct impact on that report, and the more thorough and more powers you can give to the independent assessor, which is a person which is appointed from a panel which is controlled by the CHE, and the minister can just take one from that panel. So it is a real independent process where higher education plays a critical role in the identification of your independent assessor, and the need to provide more powers and more clarity about the functions became very critical. It will provide a better report to the minister, and it will also assist that the investigation can deal with the real issues, and where all role players are forced to play or to participate and to provide this independent assessor with the information to provide a report which is justifiable in law, and also that can provide a much more focused and direct outcome which can assist in the decision making by the minister on the appropriate measures that is recommended. So the first issue that is raised in the proposed new section 45A is to enhance the powers to make sure that the independent assessor can conduct a proper investigation, and that the procedures can be developed by that independent assessor according to the needs and the circumstances of the case, and that the independent assessor may direct any category of persons or all persons who are present and not desirable at that specific investigation to be present or not to be present. It is also important that you give that person the power to focus on the issue and not necessarily be distracted. So it is a power which is a discretion. It also provides that person with the right to force any person to disclose any information relating to that investigation, and it's very focused on the investigation itself. The terms of reference that's flowing from it, which is determined by the minister, but it is done by the independent assessor, which, as I indicated, is appointed, that person relevant information and to produce any documents that is relevant to the investigation and which is under control of such a person, and to compel them to hand it over so that a meaningful outcome can be reached on relevant facts, and that there is clarity about the investigation as it is inclusive of all the factors, which is currently a major problem in the language of the current Act. It further provides a power to direct specific persons to appear before the independent assessor, and that person must also then provide specific documentation. It also can require any person to appear as a witness to give evidence under oath or information. It also provides the independent assessor with the power to enter onto the premises of that institution, any of the premises, and it can take hold of the documentation that is applicable to the investigation. Chair, it also put an obligation to the independent assessor to waive any person has been implicated during the investigation, that there is an opportunity given to that person to respond in connection with such allegations, and to take that also into account. And it also provides that person to have an opportunity to appear and to be heard. So it is, if that person wants to not only to present documentation, that person got a right to appear and to make the presentation itself, and it end off by providing the possibility of a legal representative to assist that person if it is a matter as is provided for in section 3 sub 5 of the Probation of Administrative Justice Act, where the impact of that proceedings, the complexity of those proceedings and those factors as mentioned there will be taken into account when such a decision to allow legal representatives or not comes into play. Chair, the next one, as I indicated, is also extending the powers of the independent assessor, that is the new clause 6, to enter the premises of the institution that's under investigation and to take possession of documentation that he or she may deem necessary, and to copy those documents and to make it part of the investigation. The new clause 7 is dealing with the report that must be given, and it is an amendment to the current section 47 of the Act, and which is just a extension of the current 47.1b, which currently requires that the report to the minister must contain the findings of his or her investigation, and we've just added, together with the reasons upon which these findings are based, and in the B part of that proposal, it is also to amend 47.1c, and where the current wording is to suggest appropriate measures and to add and the reasons why the measures are needed in order to put it in the context of the investigation. The next clause 8, is dealing with the intervention by the minister and the minister may issue directives which the council must take into account. The language that you would find from here onwards, it is the whole of the new section 49A up to 49E, is what is already contained in the approach that's put on the table in the National Higher Education Institutes. So therefore it is just providing the same framework, the same structure to the higher education institutions that is applicable to the higher education, the National Higher Education Institutes. The advantage of this, it's a more simpler approach when it comes to administrating this legislation, and it provides a framework within which the minister are obliged to consider alternatives as a parallel process where directives is given to the institution and not necessarily go the independent assessors route as the first option. So it brings more flexibility, it provides a more fairer approach to the institution to respond to the problem that might exist within the directives given by the minister, and allow that opportunity to the institution to address the problem within the specified time frame. If there's a failure on the part of the institution to comply with those directives, clearly the outcome will be the appointment of an administrator. Chair, that's exactly the same as what we are seeing in the same bill that is under the proposed new section 38J, which is, and further on, which is applicable to the National Higher Education Institute. Chair, the approach that's been taken in that clauses are, as I said, twofold. It also provides for the appointment of the administrator, which is much more detailed, as was the old section 41 sub 1, 41A sub 1 and 2, and Chair, which is in essence a repetition of what was stated there, but it goes much further than just providing a broad, robust framework. It also provides a more detailed approach as to what is, for instance, the impact of such an appointment. Will a council still be in existence if an administrator be appointed? There's always been a question mark. And the legal clarity that's needed to ensure that there is one structure to govern and manage the institution, even during this special circumstances that exist with the appointment of an administration, is very critical. It would be very difficult to manage a system if the council is still in existence, and the administrator must deal with the governance decisions and can be challenged by the structure because they still got an interest in the matter. Chair, the whole approach is to clarify and provide legal certainty in the same manner as it is done in section 38J, which is part and parcel of this bill. Chair, I can go through it again, but as it is part of the bill, and as I said, it's word by word exactly the same, in the sake of interest of time, I can take questions on it if needed. But that is the proposal of the minister.
Section 49A, subsection 1, paragraph 2, don't you think over the amendments, the committee at the appropriate time. Unless members might want to ask any questions for clarity. Okay. Let's proceed to our presentations. We will take our first presentation from Mr. Mutli in regard to the Higher Education and Training Qualities Amendment Bill.
Thank you, Chair. The name is Kesi Mudli, Director of the Workers' College. It's a college based in Durban. And it's been, and I'll go through the submission that is before you and try and expand on some of the issues. The submission is tabled by the Workers' College, which is a trade union and community education organization. And when we talk about a trade union, we talk of an organization that recruits trade unionists, workers from all trade union federations and organizations. It's not restricted to any specific one. As well as when we talk of community organizations, we talk of organizations that cover the entire spectrum. So there's no particular community organization that we exclude or include. The college has been in existence since 1992. It originally started as a project of the University of Natal at that time, and then has moved now to its own, since then, to its own premises in 93. And has been delivering what we call accredited diploma programs. These are 1-year programs that are accredited by the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and that has been going on since the late 90s. Prior to that, there was accreditation by Ruskin College, Oxford, as well as UNISA at one stage. And we also have a collaborative part-time social science degree with the University of KwaZulu-Natal. I note that I had omitted to submit, and I have copies of it, of the handbook, which the relevant pages of the handbook, which describe the social science degree and the relationship that the Workers' College has with the university. This degree has been in existence since 2000. Now, our submission with regard to the Further Education and Training College Amendment is directed at the amendment of Section 1 of Act 16 of 2006, and in particular, the definition of college. Now, the bill seeks to amend the definition of college in 1A, and more specifically, what is termed public college. And the proposed bill is describing it as either a technical and vocational education and training college or a community education and training college. Now, our proposal from the Workers' College, but I must say that even though I speak on behalf of the Workers' College, I speak to a broader range of adult education, service education organizations that have been in existence as long, and some longer than Workers' College, that exists throughout the country. Our proposal is that the submission around the definition needs to be expanded to include what we are terming civil society education organizations. And when we talk of civil society education organizations, we're talking of trade union and community organizations. Now, we're making this submission, and let me try and take you through our rationale. These civil society education organizations, such as the Workers' College and other like organizations, have over years designed and conducted established educational programs for civil society organizations and social activists. I must just say that at this juncture, that there are members of national parliament, provincial parliament, and local government structures who have come through these education. So we're actually speaking to people who can call, summon your programs equally develop social competencies necessary for the building of social, political, and economic justice, as well as skills that enable ordinary citizens to actively participate in the process of accumulation and production of knowledge, and to function better in various facets of life. Such programs also use as a basis of education practice the use and of recognition of prior learning. Now, in this instance, around the recognition of prior learning, we currently are part of a four-year SAKWA research project. We are one of four sites. The other three sites include UCT, University of Cape Town, University of the Western Cape, and a private service provider. The SAKWA has recognized that the Workers' College has a particular approach to RPL and a particular approach to education and the recruitment of that RPL, which is of interest to informing that discourse. If I can continue, this education practice has made tremendous achievements in terms of research output, teaching and learning methodologies, curriculum development, and education for transformation. Now, I must just say that our interaction and collaboration University of KwaZulu-Natal has not only impacted in terms of the kind of content and curriculum content that is contained there, we've also designed modules in that collaboration. But it's also changed the way in some of those faculties as to the way they teach. When we're talking of these methodologies, there's this issue of teaching. And the assumption of teaching is that a learner does not come with a particular skill or knowledge or experience. We tend to use the term facilitate, because we think there's vast knowledge of experience and skills that people bring to an education discourse. Now, just to continue, some of these organizations are currently providing diploma and degree programs. And when I talk of these organizations, I'm speaking specifically of civil society education organizations that and there are many throughout the country. They're currently providing diploma and degree programs that are either accredited by mainstream higher education public institutions or run jointly with institutions. And the Workers' College is an example of this, that we run these accredited programs that in collaboration with universities, but also in collaboration with institutions even outside. However, in any functioning democracy, this is the point that we want to make, particularly in a society with the history and reality of continuing inequalities, imbalances, and exclusions, there is a dire need for the recognition of forms of education and pedagogical practices aimed at redress, healing, and the rehumanization and recommunalization of the marginalized, disempowered, and socially disenfranchised sectors. Contesting the dominant and established education practices. That is a particular discourse that we are engaged with the higher education institutions that we work with. The recognition of the diversity and plurality of voices, perspectives, approaches and practices within education is in essence a socio-economic and human rights issue, which this bill provides an opportunity for this country to pay attention to. And I think that's our submission here, that with the reflection on how we define public colleges, we make the submission that there would be a mistake to exclude such institutions that are in existence, that have been existing on the periphery, and it is necessary for them, if we were looking for a holistic approach to education, for them to be brought in to not only the definition but into the broader education discourse. Now, in terms of supporting our argument and our proposal, we turned to two current documents that are circulating. The first one is the third National Skills Development Strategy, and the other is the Green Paper for Post-School Education and Training. And both these documents make constant reference to the recognition of work education and civil society education. And initiatives which have made valuable contributions to the education. need to be supported and recognized. And I think that's important. But if currently within the green paper, within NSDS 3, there is reference to work education and civil society, education organizations and institutions, then that might find its way in the defining of what constitutes a public college. And I think that is important. Relevant sections of these two documents, and I draw your attention to this, which speak to these issues are quoted below. The first one is the third NSDS 3 identifies as its mission the need to increase access to high quality and relevant education and training to enable effective participation in the economy and society by all South Africans and reduce inequality. Now, there is and maybe at this juncture, let me draw the distinction between the workers' college and like civil society organizations. The students who come to these institutions do not come as individuals. They come through their organizations. And fundamentally, most of these organizations are about social change. They're not about individual advancement. But I think what we are trying to say here is that in an education discourse, that whilst your institutions of higher education and further education recruit their students individually, it is absolutely vital, and I think we all have to give recognition to the fact that social change, political change, economic change is brought about by organizations for change, whether they be community organizations, trade unions, political parties, whatever. And such organizations, therefore, have to in their approach to bringing about this change, have their individuals within those organizations, their competence, their understanding of the discourse, they have to be exposed to that. And I think this is where the niche that such organizations like the Workers' College play the role, and which the NSDS 3 speaks to it. Let me just take you also to section 4.6 of the NSDS. And in that reference is made to trade unions, their education programs, as well as other work initiatives, programs and NGOs, who play an important role in the further education and training of workers in the broader sectoral policy and capacity to effectively engage in the workplace and broader economy. So there is recognition that these organizations, there is recognition that they have a role to play. There is recognition that their role is not only restricted to this whole notion of skills within a workplace, but it's has a much more broader social, political, economic role to play. And I think that's an important thing, because sometimes we get locked into a definition of education for employment rather than an education for change. And I think that's the point that we try to make. Trade unions and work, and I'm going back to the NSDS 3, trade unions and work education and training initiatives are able to use the critical networks of the organizations, for example, shop stewards and union officials, to educate their members and other workers to suit their needs in a manner that is also beneficial to the economy as a whole. Now, the point, I think, which is made by the NSDS 3 is to say that it's not important just to skill persons around a skill, but for them to understand the broader kind of social, political context in which they live. It's you can't skill someone to do something without them understanding as to what is the broader contribution they make to the society at large. And I think that is a value that we have to try and engage with, because quite often what happens is that we become individualistic. We become separated by the broad transformation agenda that we must be involved. And I think organizations like your civil society, education organizations, speak to that, because they speak to organizational discourse. Now, South Africa has a long, and again I'm going back to the NSDS 3, South Africa has a long history of work education and training that needs to be supported and expanded. Work-initiated education and training can contribute to a workforce that is better able to understand the challenges facing the economic sectors in which they operate. So they need to understand the broader challenges and not just understand how do I become an apprentice to become a plumber or whatever, but to see it in a broader context and what is my contribution to the society at large. This would benefit the workplace, our economy, as well as the developmental objectives of our country. And the NSDS. 3 will support NGO, community and work initiatives, skill development and training programs. The NSF will similarly aim to support credible and quality partners, skill development, education and training. Now, the issue of quality, again, is an issue of where you say, for these broader civil society education institutions, how do we judge the quality? How do we determine whether they are running quality education? And that is why our collaboration over the years, not only the Workers' College, but other institutions, but higher education institutions, have been able to impact on that and actually influence discourses within the higher education, which is important. Just a few more references to the NSDS 3. The NSDS outcome 4.6.3 states that worker, NGO, and community-based education programs are supported and that impact measures are reported on, and that the output should be that CETAs engage with trade unions, NGOs, and community-based organizations. And in section 6 of the NSDS, it says building partnerships for a skilled revolution. I would assume that the term revolution is not used in the militant sense, just used in a more creative sense, although we may at times preach a revolution ourselves, but not in this state. But what it says here is a partnership and collective responsibility between stakeholders, government, business organizations, trade unions, constituency bodies. And I think what's important here is that when you look at social partners in your society, you have to say that there is government, and government has resources and builds its capacity. There is business, which has resources. But there is this broader civil society, and it is this civil society which is under-resourced, which is underdeveloped, which needs to develop capacity. And this is where organizations, education organizations, like the college, makes a contribution to that. Let me not read the whole thing, but suffice to say that the NSDS talks of building these partnerships for developing a change. The revolution concept is bringing about a change in the landscape, not only of skills, but of understanding what is the broader social agenda that needs to be. Then I turn, with your permission, Chair, to the Green Paper for Post-Education Training. And again, the Minister, and I must just say that the Minister has visited the Workers' College, and he has attended our graduation ceremonies, and he's encouraged us to, as ministers, occupy space, because that voice needs to be heard. And in his Green Paper on Post-Education and Training, states that his department is located at the nexus between formal education system and the workplace. Now, we want to believe that between formal education system and the workplace exists civil society education institutions, and this is where we fit in. And he also states that particular attention will have to be paid to the education and training needs of the overwhelming majority of our people, the workers and the poor. And workers, the poor, and poor coming out of community organizations, is the constituency that are served by these education institutions. Now, let me just quickly refer to some sections in the Green Paper. Under funding, he says, at the same time, the design of our qualifications framework and quality assurance system has in some instances made it difficult for providers to offer non-formal programs. And I think there's an emphasis there on non-formal, because I think there's a recognition that there's a lot of education that is going on outside formal institutions. And that education has contributed to a tremendous amount of change that has brought about the society and recognition. And he talks of it's difficult to give such recognition, as the other says, being on formal qualifications and human status. In some parts of the system, this may have led to a reduction in the already small amount of education provision and contributed to the general collapse of not-for-profit and community-based provision and youth development organizations. So he speaks specifically to the kinds of organizations that I speak on behalf of. For many providers offering short programs aimed at professional organizational community development, it is difficult to fit the training that they do into unit standards. And again, yes, there's a problem that compartmentalizing education becomes a problem. And I think there is that view So let alone find accredited assessors to assess it and moderate it and verify it and moderate it and verify it. Such organizations have struggled. And when I see the term struggle, I'm assuming he's not using it in a political struggle, but he probably would. Such organizations have struggled to get funding, as both international donors and our own government have assumed that anyone providing any kind of training must fit into a quality assurance system. Now, let me speak differently to that. Currently, both the National Skills Fund as well as the Department of Labor have a special fund which is called Strengthening Civil Society Fund. And the Strengthening Civil Society Fund has been funding organizations like the Workers' College, like DITSELA, which is the National Education Institute, over the years, for many years. Because they believed that you have to strengthen civil society organizations. And that speaks to what we are talking about. Again, in the green paper in 4.4, community education and training centers under the overview 4.4.1, adult and youth learning also take place through a variety of non-formal community and popular education initiatives and projects run by community-based organizations, CBOs, trade unions, social movements. So again, the green paper speaks to the constituency and institutions and organizations that we speak on behalf of. Again, in 4.4.2, a vision for community education and training, the community education training approach to adult learning internationally seeks to facilitate a cycle of lifelong learning in communities and offers routes to enable the development of skills, including literacy and numeracy skills, to enhance personal, social, family, and employment experiences. And I think here we're talking about education. It further seeks to assist community organizations, local government, and individuals to work together to develop and enhance their communities by building on their existing resources. So, a reference to RPR. So, Chair, our first submission was about trying to substantiate our suggestion that the definition of public colleges needs to be expanded to include this. The second part of our submission speaks to the continuing education and training. Now, the bill seeks to insert the definition of continuing education and training. And our proposal is that such definition needs to be extended to include levels 1 to 5. I do know that prior to this, the legislation spoke to 2 to 4. The legislation currently wants to say speak to 1 to 4. We are saying it needs to be extended to 1 to 5. And the rationale for that is this. A number of civil society organizations, and again, we're talking of education civil society organizations, including the Workers' College, conduct accredited qualifications which are at least at the level of 5. Now, when we're talking of level 5, currently, for example, the diploma programs of the Workers' College serve not only as a qualification which is equivalent to a matric certificate, but also serve as an entry qualification into the university. And if one of our students already has a matric, then it serves as a 16-credit module at a university level. So it speaks to level 5, if not higher. Now, these qualifications provide an important link for the adult learners in these programs who move into higher education qualifications and serve as bridging courses into the academy. Now, one of the realities we know is that in higher education, this move from a formalistic type secondary education into higher education, you find your first years are all over. Of dropouts, changing of courses, and so on, difficulty to adjust. When we in the college do these programs, we already are equipping them to fit in with our approach is not the teaching approach that is adopted primarily in primary secondary schools of pouring knowledge and fitting it out, but rather facilitating an engagement with what people know. So it equips them to fit in to get into these higher education institutions. And I think that's a role that we play. But in saying that, you need to give recognition to the fact that when we play that role, we're now operating at a level 5, possibly level 6, in terms of your human standards or whatever you call it. Okay? So, back to my rationale. Such adult learners also have acquired vast experiences and prior knowledge in their organizations, workplaces, and communities, which are given due recognition to the RPL. And I think the discourse on RPL is very important, because when we seek to accredit and recognize our people through years of struggle, political, social, economic struggle, have acquired vast experiences, skills, competencies, knowledge, which need to give that recognition, which has actually shaped the nature in which this country needs to be and where the direction we can go. The higher education institutions themselves have attached value to such programs and regard them as access to into their institutions. And that is the example I give of working colleagues. Now, I have, I'll just take you through the supporting documentation, which is an accreditation of the Workers' College for diplomas. But also there is another document which speaks, which is a handbook of UKZN, which talks to the collaboration that we have as the Workers' College with them in developing a social science part-time degree. And this speaks to the issue of standard and quality as well. So in conclusion, we want to say that it is the contention of the Workers' College that the recognition of the long-existing civil society education organizations will not only add value to the whole post-school approach, but also include a huge sector of civil society organizations that continue to exist outside the education formal system, but have made and continue to make enormous contributions to building a new society, a new education discourse, and a new citizenship. Now, just to very quickly put up on the screen, this is the UKZN alternative access document that we have, which speaks to the four diplomas that we have: labor studies, labor economics, gender and labor studies, and political studies. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Questions by the panel to present? I'm sure we seem to be impressed by the fact that the definition of a college is inclusive as much as those institutions that are contributing to provision of education, and that enables the department in the future to be able to tackle questions of assessing standards to quality be produced and enabling collaboration to occur in that area and facilitate support by state institutions to be able to continue the work. I think members are impressed. Silence denotes consent. I'm told.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one point of clarity. I would love for the Workers' College to expand. I think from the presentation, yes, Workers' College, you are having a close relationship with the teachers through the NSF, the Marriott. And you were also talking of the funding, maybe from the department or the government. I just want you to clarify that one on the issue of funding as such. As to say, for me, the way you've presented, I think you do benefit from that fund, and it has kept you going up so far. I'm not getting it well as to say, when you talk on the issue of funding, exactly, what is it, what more, or where do you wish to see the government getting in when we're talking of funding, so that, yes, Chairperson, you are correct. I think that the private colleges they do play a very important role in our country, and we appreciate very much what they're doing. But can we talk more, a little bit more on that issue of funding? Thank you.
No, the reason why I made reference to the funding was to draw your attention to the fact that existing, both the Department of Labor and the Department of Higher Education do support us, which means that they give us recognition. Because this submission is about now getting that recognition within the legislative structures. So the submission is change or extend the definition of public colleges to include these civil society education institutions, like the Workers' College, like the CERA, like the Labor Resource Service, and so on, so that we then get that recognition and it is then given that weight, that legal weight of that it does exist, that it is part of the broader education discourse. Unless the Honourable Member is suggesting that she wants to make contributions to the college, we welcome it. If you can give me your address, we'll send you an invoice, which we normally do. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Also, just for my own clarity, if one looks at the bill with the proposed amendments, according to that definition, it says a college means a public college that is established or declared as, and then they have two, a technical and vocational education and training college, or a community education and training college. Would you want a third? Or because a community education college, so you are happy with the community education college?
I'm glad you are looking after my happiness. The community and education college, the definition is restrictive because that community education talks of adult education. It doesn't speak to civil society education institutions that exist. So it could either be an additional, a third descriptor, or it could be an extension of that public. It could read, for example, community education and training college, which includes civil society education organizations like trade unions and community education. So, or it could be a third one, which would read 1-2, Roman numeral 3, a civil society education institution.
What happens? The follow-up to these submissions, are they attended to or adhered to according to the submissions here? How do they work on them? Just like 7 good, kunama submissions. As I with different requests, would you make a big edge? How possible is that? By a way, I am able to make sure with everybody also paying in like a party, a rabbit dog out of school because of in to pay away in mind.
Complex diverse thoughts emerging from the
very, very important submission. I think one of the things that the portfolio committee must look at is that when we're looking at an education discourse and we're looking at trying to bring about change within a society, you have to ask the question, who brings about this change? Who effects change? You know, and one of the very important partners in bringing about this change is civil society. But not civil society as individuals, but civil society as organizations. And that if we continue to marginalize or ignore the fact that these organizations need to be strengthened, need to be built, need to be developed. And when I say organizations, the individuals who function in these organizations. Because these organizations serve the public interest. They serve the, just as Parliament serves the public interest, these organizations serve the public interest. And if they do not get that recognition and that support and that development and so on, then the change within your society is lopsided. You're going to get a change in society that continues to be brought about either by government and business, but your broader civil society, which constitutes, if I may be bold enough to say, the vast majority of the people, are not given the true recognition of what impact education must have. Now, currently, the way education is done is it's done individually. We go to look for money for ourselves, we go and get a career, we get a certificate, we get a photograph, we frame the photograph, we put it up in our homes, and everybody who visits us, they get very pleased that the individual is now graduated. Does it change the society? To a very limited extent. But if an individual who's working in a civil society organization, and such organization is about bringing about change, and you develop that individual, through that individual who works through that organization, you get a much more broader effect than just taking it. And I think that is the value that we add to a broader education discourse. Thank you. Become state institutions. We are a civil society. However, what we are saying is that we are submitting ourselves to the broader education standards and discourse that exist within the public sphere. So that's the one thing. The second thing is that we are quite clear that we are not a private institution. We are not an institution that is contributing towards personal gain. We are a public institution. And therefore, as a public institution, and we can name many people in Parliament who have come through our institutions. As a public institution, we're making a contribution to the public good and the advancement of the public. And I think that is why we are choosing to propose an amendment to the definition of public colleges. And that's what we are saying. Because definitely our agenda is not an advancement of the self-enrichment. It's an advancement of social change. Thank you.
Just for my satisfaction, but I'm not an organ of the state. Maybe this will clarify in my mind. You are not an organ of the state, but you regard yourself to be providing education to society, therefore you are fulfilling a public purpose in some way, and you expect state support to that extent.
If I can just add to that discourse, as civil society, we're not an organ of the state, but the state belongs to us. So you're an organ of us. Thank you.
Intellectually, you're on the same plane.
Yeah.
I think the aspect that we will clarify in the discourse is whether we should include you in the definition of a college in the context of this bill. Whether you should remain a dictionary definition, not a legal definition for the purposes of this act. That will debate at later stage. Yeah.
A clarity in the kind of the amendment which you request on the definition of colleges. It's unfortunate that my narrow understanding would be there is a reason why a public college is defined as it is. And there are many other things. A college is not only programs offering, it's not only about that. I don't think it's only about that. There are many other things that relate to what makes a college to be what it is. And now I was just thinking, and we have programs like CTAS, for instance, for playing the role that you are also defining as it is, looking more on issues of prior learning experience, which there people can be accredited through that. And I'm asking myself a question, really, will this not supposed to fall in the category of what CTAS are doing currently? And there's a debate about institutes now also. Maybe we can't locate what we're trying to raise in the context. Because you must qualify to be something. You must be something first to be a college. Then you don't just have an open-handed type of developing colleges. There are certain specifications that you must meet to be an academic institution to offer programs. And clarify me, because I think you fall into the issue of CTAS, which they are working so well. Why you can't locate this concept that you're coming with within the context of the CTAS program?
Before I allow you to respond, at one stage I'm sure we'll come in the debate. The issue here is the intention of this legislation, I mean this bill, in the end when it becomes legislation, does it want to address itself to only public colleges? Or does it also want to regulate affairs of private colleges? If it does so, definitely we'll have to consider re-energizing
and there's a number of examples. In Oxford University, Oxford University has what they call a Ruskin College. A Ruskin College is a college. It's a college in its own standing, but it caters purely for trade unions and trade union organizations and representatives. But its structure, it has a college, it has its courses that it offers along social, economic, political discourses. You can choose a degree, a diploma, honors, masters, whatever. You can do all of that. But its structure is a college. The Workers' College, like many other institutions, has diploma programs that run for a year. They have a part-time degree that runs for 5 years in collaboration with the university. They accept students into that. But the difference is that, and there are two fundamental differences. One is that the students who come onto these programs as a college, there's quality control, they submit assignments, they write exams. This is not your 3-day, 5-day unit standard kind of thing. And it fits in with the way in which a university works. The difference, of course, is that the way we recruit our students. Who are these students? They come through organizations. And we are saying that what is necessary is that in our society, there are civil society organizations, trade unions, community organizations. We even get members of parliament, local government, coming in to our courses, because they do not find that space, that kind of institute, that education, specifically to their needs. So the recruitment of these people, you could say they are public interest people. They represent public interest. But they're coming here into our college, which is run as a college, which is run as an education institution, with all its structures and so on, to cater for broader social discourse, political discourse. CETA, and I may differ with you that CETAs are run well, or how well they are run, but that's another. We can meet during lunch. I can even quote the minister on his view about what CETAs are. But CETAs are narrowing their perspective. They develop somebody's skill and they put you back in the workplace. And then the workplace becomes disrupted because people don't understand what is the contribution to it. We have a much more broader, holistic approach. And it's about education. It's not. It's this debate around what is education and what is training. You know, you can train somebody within CETA, but you educate the person. Thank you, Chair.
The moment that I get to understand, in terms of would you want to regulate affairs to some extent of private colleges?
Thank you, Chairperson. The further education and training colleges includes both public and private. It's actually the responsibility of the states to regulate, but not to the extent that they become organs of state, etc. So the constitution that you referred to is that we have, and private does not mean does not mean for profit. Private can mean not for profit as well as for profit. So I just wanted to give that particular clarity that you.
That helps us. We'll debate at the right time and how then to articulate the space of private colleges in the meaning of a college so that they should not be excluded in the definition but included in regulation, because that will create a legal problem in the future. Because a legal definition must include all the things that you must then control. Because if they are not the outside definition, they are outside of your control. If they're outside of the legal definition, you can call them to be within the purview of your control. So we'll look at that and see how we shape the meaning of college. Let's proceed to the second presentation. I must thank you for your presentation. It's very helpful, and we're still going to study it at home as well for our own empowerment.
Sorry, Chair, are you inviting me to visit you at home? Okay, thank you.
We are just working on the, we asked to have more copies made and it seems that they have not yet arrived, but my colleague will be handing out the copies in the meantime. Members of the Portfolio Committee, fellow invitees, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Stephen Smith. My colleagues, Mr. Short Fitzhenry, Gavin Everett. We represent Education South Africa. It's a voluntary body of language training schools across South Africa, and of course we would like to take the opportunity to thank the committee for inviting us. Here today. We're also affiliated to SATEC, the South African Youth Travel Confederation. In addition, we're affiliated to ALTO, the Association of Language Travel Organizations, which represents schools such as ours and worldwide. Mr. Chair, at present, there are about 45 language schools in South Africa, of which plus minus 50% are either full or associate members of EduSA. In my presentation, unfortunately, there are no white or green papers that I can refer to, but it is my hope that coming out of these discussions here today, that such a paper might be developed at a later stage. So our aim here today is to present our case for change or amendment in legislation, which will allow us to become government accredited and recognized as important role players in the field of further education and training. It is of course also to try and relay our stated aims of job creation and economic development in South Africa. In short, our wish is for government to see the benefits to be had and to create an enabling environment for the EFL industry in which to function. At this point, I'd like to, of course, introduce and ask Mr. Gavin Eyre to just give the committee and other people present here today a brief overview of the EFL industry globally. Gavin.
Mr. Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I would like to introduce a concept that we as Education South Africa Global Alliance of Education Language Associations, ALTO, the Association of Language Travel Organizations, and StudyWise, part of the World Youth Student Travel Association. All the associations that I've mentioned address the following global issues: the global migration of students, quality assurances, visa issues, and the need for global recognition of student mobility. We therefore believe, or the associations that I represent on behalf of EdUSA, we firmly believe that governments and agencies and institutions should promote the desirability of study abroad, promote international student mobility through all available means, encourage student exchange schemes at institutional and regional levels, deliver programs through institutional partnerships such as 2 and 3 center degree courses, ensure that high school leavers have a competence in a foreign language, structure visa systems to facilitate student mobility, reducing cost and complexity, treat students as temporary migrants outside any country of net migration, and establish a forum or agency under the United Nations to act as the champion of international study. Language schools, ladies and gentlemen, are feeders into universities, colleges, and higher education institutions. And in most other countries, apart from this country, it provides forex, increased fees for international students, which helps to fund our own students through these tough financial times, a great international student mix, opportunities for our students to gain important cultural exposure to all the foreign students that would have and could have the possibility of coming to this country. We need to be recognized so that we can receive EU funding, or the students can receive EU funding and other government funding, which at this present moment in time we can't. Stephen.
Thank you, Gary. I'd like to continue by giving you a brief history of language training schools globally and in South Africa. The ours is a relatively new industry in South Africa. Countries such as the United States of America, Canada, England, and the rest of the United Kingdom, New Zealand, and Australia saw the establishment of schools as far back as 1935. Even though research has shown that the first language school came into being in 1987, meaning here in South Africa, it was only after attaining democracy in 1994 that South Africa's language training destination really came to the fore, with the establishment of plus minus 6 schools in the first 10 years, and that happened mainly in and around Cape Town. Since 2004, the number of language schools increased dramatically so, and many of these schools can now be found in major centers such as Johannesburg, Pretoria, Durban, and Port Elizabeth. Question arises here, what do? We teach English and other languages to foreigners. All schools have agents around the world who recruit students on their behalf. These students come here to either learn from scratch or to improve their knowledge of the chosen language. Important to note here is that in recent years, Africa, and in particular the SADC region, has been showing a lot of growth in terms of language learning. Now, this is absolutely in line with what is happening in the rest of the world. If you take, for example, countries such as New Zealand, you will find that the higher concentration of students there would be your Japanese, your Chinese, as well as your Koreans, because it's in close these countries are in close proximity to one another. And that is the reason why the SADC region is showing such a lot of growth, apart from the fact that more and more we have more stability in African countries, particularly so in countries such as Mozambique, Angola, which is a big reservoir where we are drawing our students from. And so the SADC has been showing a lot of growth. I mentioned the SADC because of the fact that 5% of places at our universities, as you might know, are reserved for students from this region, and we, as language schools, play a huge role in accepting these students at our institutions and preparing them for their studies at English medium universities in South Africa. On average, it takes about 9 to 10 months to get a student from an absolute beginner, meaning where a person cannot speak English at all. It takes about 9 to 10 months to get such a student ready to attend a university here in South Africa. In this regard, our positioning allows us to act as a sort of a bridge between foreign education departments and South African universities. What do we offer? What do we teach? As I said, we teach English. That being general English, business English, academic English, and in recent years, more and more, we have the English, the ESP, as we call it in our industry, coming to the fore. That being English for aviation, financial English, medical, oil exploration, and so on and so forth. Structure of our courses, you would have it from a beginner going right up to your proficiency level, where people can function as what we are doing here. Important to note that schools such as ours also offer the following externally written and awarded exam courses. There's the IELTS course, which is the International English Language Testing System. This is accredited by Cambridge University, the English as a Second Official Language Department. There's the TOEFL, which is the Test of English as a Foreign Language, and other various English exams, such as your first certificate in English, your advanced certificate in English, and so on and so forth. And these are all exams that is externally written, and the students would get their qualifications not from any of the schools in South Africa, but directly from the University of Cambridge. We also engage in teacher training. In South Africa, we train many, many teachers who leave from here and then go and teach in countries such as Korea, the United Arab Emirates, and everywhere and anywhere where English teachers are needed. And I might add that these people are highly sought after. We are in the process of, I think, overtaking the Canadians and the Americans in this regard. Two qualifications I'd like to draw your attention to. That would be the SALTA, which is regarded as the entry-level qualification for English language teachers worldwide. And then there's, of course, the DELTA, which is a diploma, a higher qualification, and which will also allow you, after this qualification, to go on and do a master's degree. Important to note that the University of Cambridge ESOL department trusts schools in South Africa to do these courses. And unfortunately, we cannot say the same at this moment in time for our government, and that's, I think, the reason why we are here. SALTA, for your information, is accredited from the Office of Qualifications and Exams Regulations in the United Kingdom at their NQF Level 5. And the DELTA is recognized and accredited at the NQF Level 7. What do we bring to the party in terms of job creation and the economy? In 2011, the Department of Trade and Industry commissioned the Urban Econ Development Economist to do a composite report on the value of education exports and educational tourism to the economy. Now, the document that you have in front of you here, there is a summary of that document. It is this summary, and it summarizes what the DTI report threw up. But just in short, the number of jobs created by our industry is 15,698. In 2009, the total value of education exports, 11.5 billion rand. This is what our industry was worth to the South African economy in 2009. Specifically, language courses brought into the economy 2.6 billion rand. When these people are here, they come for anything between 2 weeks up to 1 year. They have friends and relatives visiting them. These people also bring money into the economy. stated at 1.8 billion for the year 2009. 20,825 international students studied at about 50 language schools throughout South Africa. The report also found, and I quote, "The highest increase in demand for tertiary education is in sub-Saharan Africa, standing at 8.6% per annum." Question is, what is happening in other countries? How are these people doing it? And what are we trying to tell this portfolio committee? Language trading is one of the largest and most valuable education export educational tourist market segments. The total value of the language travel market globally is $8 billion United States dollars per year. Currently, we have 1.4% of the global market. In New Zealand, schools are recognized and accredited by the Department of Education and the NZQA, which is the same as our SACWA. Australia schools are recognized and accredited by the Department of Education in the United Kingdom and in Canada. Important to note is that all of these governments recognize the value and importance of this industry to their respective economies, and as a result, they have gone about creating enabling environments for these institutions in which to operate. Why do we seek accreditation and recognition? Because it will allow us to compete with these countries on an equal footing, Mr. Chair. It will allow us to increase our market share in the global market, and it will enable us to enter into working arrangements and agreements with mainstream universities, both in South Africa as well as the rest of the world. It will allow us to issue letters of acceptance and provisional enrollment. Now these letters, Mr. Chair, are needed for foreign students to come into the country and to acquire the necessary study permit. As I'm speaking to you now, we are having students turned down for study permits. I'd like to draw your attention to a letter which is attached to the back of some of the documents that you have here there, and it is a letter from dating back to 1996 when the Honourable Katsapo Teleri was still the minister, and there was a special dispensation given or directive given to embassies and consulates around the world to issue students with study permits, because this is as far back as we go with this issue pertaining to study permits and things like that. And at that time the minister saw what was happening and he issued these directives, and that helped us. But that of course was a short-term solution, and we are now sitting again with problems surrounding that issue. Now you might ask us, ladies and gentlemen, where do we feel we fit in? It is our opinion that from a recognition and accreditation point of view, we fit in with education, more specifically further education and training. From a commercial point of view, you might tell us that we fit in with tourism. Fact of the matter is we have knocked on all these doors. And that is the reason why we are here. I'd like to conclude by putting our proposals on the table. We need to find a way forward by which the government can recognize us as important role players in the field of further education and training. And perhaps a study should be done on how governments in the other countries have been handling it. Finally, should this portfolio committee find that it is impossible to accommodate us, we seek guidance to what we can do so that the economic benefits and proven job creation potential can be further enhanced to the benefit of us all. I thank you.
I think Tafelkuza is part of that division. They should be able to have a way of interacting with this institution to look at possibilities. And I'm sure he says yes, well, these people can provide academic English. And we thought we could ask them to do a bit of a dry run with members of parliament, but we are going for the committee on academic English. Because we are always dealing with very complex people like professors, academics, like Mr. McBeam, Dr. McBeam. So, I will take a few questions. I'm sure we've got one. Yeah, there are many. Two.
Are they teaching specific people to master a certain language so that if it is Sotho, that person can be sent in front of a class and teach Sotho, even if he's white, things like that? Thank you.
Jefferson, thank you. I've got one question was to say, do you have any relationship with the Department of Basic Education when it comes to language teaching? Because we know it's one of the areas that is very much needed. Because I would recommend Jefferson that, again, that is one of the departments that they need to work closer with and create strong relationship.
At our level, we have mandated the FIOS to make them engage better with SACWA around accreditation. You know, as a portfolio committee, we are not very complex at that level. But I think we are a very good bridge. Parliament accepts anything. You know, we're like a judge. You just take all the evidence and assess later the evidence and choose which one is admissible and relevant and all that. So we're doing exactly that. We're channeling the information to the right people, and they'll definitely engage with after I'm sure he's giving you the card immediately in front of us. Now, I'm sure that will facilitate now that engagement, and I must thank you for your presentation. I think it's very important. You'd like to say something before we call the next presentation? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to answer the question about language tuition in the broader context of African languages. It is a commercially driven sector that we're in, so we supply to the demand. And the demand from an international level at this point in time is largely for English, either for business purposes, for the purposes of doing business internationally, or as in the case of the school that I manage, there's a great demand for English for aviation, because all international pilots have to have a certain level of English in order to be able to fly, to get a license. Having said that, though, many schools do offer additional languages, ranging from African languages to European languages. So again, I can speak from my own experience. The school that I run in the Eastern Cape is in the Eastern Cape, so it also offers isiXhosa,
and it offers Afrikaans. It also offers German because some of the major auto manufacturing companies are in the Eastern Cape, and people who are going to Germany to do an internship at Volkswagen, for instance, are required to have a certain level of German to get their work permit. So we do address those issues, and in fact I know that one of the best COSA teachers in Port Elizabeth is a white guy. He's quite old and he grew up in the deep Eastern Cape. So where there's demand for that, we certainly do try to address it, and I think I can speak for almost all of our schools. The focus is on English because that's what the international market comes here to do, and they come here to experience learning English in a multicultural and multilingual environment, and we expose them to that culture. We certainly take them out of their comfort zones and teach them everything that we can within that limited space of time. But there probably is more that we could do given recognition by Department of Education. As to the question about basic education, we have been there. We've knocked on that door to some extent, and we've been told that what we do is adult and skilled, and therefore not with basic education. I don't know how right I am. It's quite a complicated issue. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Pumulo Mukwili from South African Women in Cooperatives. I would like to thank this opportunity to come and make this presentation to the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training. not alone from SAWICO. I'm with my president. I'm the deputy president of South African Women in Cooperatives, and I'm with my president here, Mr. Ntewana, and I'm also with the head of training, our head of training and development, who's Miss Beauty Mbangula. And the president is going to make the presentation, and we will fill in during question time where it's necessary. Thank you.
Management of cooperative affairs, financial management and record keeping, access access to information of, on finance and other support services, access to markets and competitive forces, operational and technical challenges. Now, Chair, I'm going to take you through the external factors affecting cooperatives. I will obviously mention illiteracy, even though one might say illiteracy belongs to the basic education. But we believe that illiteracy would also, can be also escalated to higher education, Chair. And I think we need to redefine illiteracy. I will give an example, Chairperson. A white person that cannot read and write, what do you call it? Is that illiteracy? Well, I will leave it to the House to decide. And also the second one would be limited mentorship programs. We do not also have effective cooperative institutes that would directly look at the challenges of cooperatives. We have lack of dedicated units in various departments belonging to the government. And also there is no specific budget for cooperative development. Now, as SAWIKO, we believe, Chair, that the challenges listed above call for an institutional framework which will provide strategic and strong visionary leadership working alongside government in supporting cooperatives. There is indeed a need to save the nation from value of debt. As you can look at that diagram or picture, whereby we do research and all of a sudden the bridge just collapsed because there is no mentorship, there is no support for children. Now, which route should we take as South Africans? So we could therefore propose that the conversion, actually we support the conversion of adult education and training centers into community adult centers. Community business schools, Chairperson, are found throughout the world. And we are saying, while planning for that, cooperative development should also be taken into consideration. So we would therefore like to propose the establishment of a cooperative institute. And our specific proposals are incubation centers that will seek to provide long-term and short-term programs, e.g. management skills that include financial skills that will also address personal budgeting. We have a critical problem, Chair, whereby the government is giving out grants, but because majority of the communities do not have a personal budgeting, hence that those monies are channeled wrongly or incorrectly, so to put it. Our target, Chair, includes rural communities because we believe that that community group is being neglected, even though we talk about it day in, day out. But something is never done. We want to bring back the land board for the people who are in the rural area. The government today is issuing out land to previously disadvantaged people. Now the question is, do those people have skills to manage the land that is given to them? So we are saying we want to emphasize on land board, and we believe that those community centers would address such issues. Coming back to a language barrier, those people on farms, they can only speak Afrikaans, they can only speak their mother tongue. But when coming to English language, most business plans are wanted or written in English, and those people cannot even express themselves in English. They are not, in fact, this does not even exclude a white boy that you find there as a manager. He also needs help in terms of English, in terms of mother tongue. I think this country should reach a point whereby business plans should be written in any language that a person could actually write. And we want to emphasize also on recognition of prior learning. Chairperson, previously or in those olden days, you would find an old woman, you know, doing her own personal budgeting. She would always carry a white handkerchief that would have here it will be a knob of the for the house, for the household, and here for the church, here for etc. etc. You will find a various knob, and that to us is we are saying that is child learning, and people need to be escalated to what is happening, you know, currently. And also, Chair, our focus is on domestic workers as well as gardeners. Most of us here have left domestic workers looking after our children. Do those people have primary health care? Should anything happen to your child, this person does not have skills to assist your child. When coming to gardeners, we are talking of food insecurity. We could actually skill these people to be able to plant food, to be able to look after our environment as we are faced with climate change. We are talking also of au pair, that is looking after our children whilst we are at work, and cooking lessons. Do these people, as they are cooking for us, do they know the safety standards of cooking? We, Chairperson, we are taking risks with our lives as South Africans. And that is because of lack of education. Chair, we also address the issue of people with disabilities. We believe that those people can use their hands in ICT. They can also use their mouth in interpreting for the court. They can also use their hands in beauty care. So these people can also be fully utilized in terms of skills. And as Sawiko, we believe in a model of an educator, whereby it got a different layer. The first layer would be the core, where we find that as Sawiko. And then we're not alone, we are using professionals and mentors. As we are here with our head of department for training and development. And the third leg, Chair, we are saying we need to be using the graduates to pay back, actually, to Sawiko or any other organization. And the last leg would be our partnership with government as well as corporate. In Sawiko, Chair, we also believe in monitoring and evaluation. That has to be emphasized. And because that indicates early warning, you know, the robot, the red light. And we will also ensure, we actually emphasize on regular meetings and reporting by cooperatives. My new chair, this is not practiced by cooperatives. So we want to sell this idea to this department so that it can take it into consideration. In conclusion, Chair, education is key to mankind. And community centers can make a difference in effectively changing lives of South Africans. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we really appreciate your presentation to the extent that you support community education and training colleges, and you would like that to also have an aspect of cooperative development and support to be able to ensure the participation of this sector into the economy. I think it's a matter which you raised an issue that the issues that is being contemplated should also deal with matters of cooperatives. I'm sure they are listening. The bill as it stands says that the minister will be entitled to the areas that could be looked at, and I'm hoping that that will be taken home. There should be an engagement with maybe rural development and land reform as to what sort of support can be given to this organization as it relates to issues of food security. I think that is very, very crucial. Any questions, colleagues?
Thank you. I think I need to comment again. It was a good presentation, really. And as the chair said, I'm happy the department is there because at least they have added so much for community other centers that have been developed by the department. But again, Chairperson, for me, is to ask their relationship and how are they working with the sector's concerns, because I think really what they are doing, we should see a lot of the engagement with the sector. And also with other departments, like looking at the specific budget for cooperative development and whatsoever, as the chairperson has mentioned, because I believe given DTI there is a lot that is being done to develop the cooperatives. But really I think we should appreciate it to put to the side of education and aid, of which is highly appreciated. But I think even working well with other departments, DTI, I know the Deputy Minister Elders is very much passionate with this one. So, but specifically, tell me the relationship with the sector and how well, as best to say, how can we step in and answer that? Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Emma Potkai. Siyabonga. Mami Chinta Imbohota. Angeke nigaye. Mami Chinta ngendlela efanele. Kodwa ke uma ama-co-ops angenaba ande ashone deep to all the areas, amakhosikazi angakhuphuka. Ayawadinga ama-co-ops amakhosikazi. How old are you, Sawiko? How old is Sawiko? And from the co-ops that you mentioned, are they national or still provincial or regional? And do you have any contact or address where you can be reached by the women? Thank you, sir.
I just want to find out if Sawiko has any links with rural areas first. Secondly, I'm interested in their cooperation with the Department of Rural Development and Land Affairs, as well as Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. On a lighter note, Chair, in the Valley of Death, I see a skull of an animal. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. You can see that there was a women's touch in that presentation. There are flowers, everything is looks so nice, and it's good. No, I think the areas that you have touched, firstly, I must say, I want to know the gaps in terms of training that this cooperative. Is there something that you are currently doing now about it? But I think the concept you are bringing of a cooperative institute, it's a very good, I think it's one area that not only women cooperatives are failing, that general cooperatives in the country have those limitations, which if we talk of better cooperative institute. It's what we need in the country, because the whole concept of collective, in which we are also raising education, that we need and bringing a collective capacity. Because the government put more money. We in agriculture went to Northwest, the cooperative, they were given everything by government, more than 18 million. They just decided to fight and eat the chicken and the birds that we gave them. Because it's difficult to work in collectives if you are not properly trained. Therefore, that concept, I think, the department should think very deeply, because that's what we need. Because cooperatives are across the board. It can be in housing, it can be in fisheries, and so on and so on. I just wanted to say, whilst I'm asking that question, are you doing something about it now? But the concept in general.
Let me allow the President to summarize those questions so that we move to the next presentation. We were having what we call functional tea. Somehow when you speak, we have tea in our bodies, you know, it just comes in and we are sustained. So we are passing that everybody, that's what we have tea in the body. We'll go outside, there's tea. But some of us always speak, become hot naturally, and we think there's no need for tea.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I must say that to answer Uma Malapa, Sawiko is only a year old, and members of Sawiko have been there. And as I said earlier, Uti, they started a primary cooperative. But Baba Nama problem. And then Tina, our commission mandate is to address not to a part of those problems. So we've learned from our past failures. Hence, we came together as primary cooperative to formulate a secondary cooperative, as a Ama primary cooperative. And Tikale, some of us are educators, some of us are also farmers. Answer Uba Malana, and we also have our advisors from Kenya, from Lesotho, from Botswana, and a few weeks ago actually we had an opportunity to go to a cooperative conference in Zambia. So what we do is we do have allies in Africa as to how can we develop cooperatives in the country. We are very, very serious, Mama, about cooperatives, and we really do not want to fail, as we have failed previously. We operate nationally, and also our contacts are at the back of, I think they are there, for presentation, yeah. And yeah, any links with rural development, I must say I'm also a farmer, and I have passion. I'm a cattle farmer. I also grow chicken. So a few weeks ago, we went to Rustenburg, where we find places that buildings that are lying fallow, actually buildings that were used by the former government of Bufutatswana. And we approached rural development into saying, "What are you doing with these buildings? We want our people to utilize them optimally. We are planning to build chicken houses whereby the cycle area is about 2 months, whereby people can buy and people of Northwest can also have shares, and they can also buy from that operational cooperative there. So money will be circulating around Northwest. And in terms of having linked with the CETAS, we are actually in a process of approaching CETAS. As I have mentioned, that we are fairly a new organization, and we really mean business. We have already approached some departments, but then the challenge that we've been having, you know, when you start a business, you need to depend on members, you need to depend on yourself, and there hasn't been financial
support that is coming from any government department. We've actually just started a relationship with social development in housing, and we are currently training the primary cooperatives that are beneficiaries of social development in housing in terms of cooperative development. And that includes cooperative governance, because we feel that that is a key problem in terms of cooperatives. I think I've answered the gaps that are there in training. And yes, Chairperson, I think I've tried to answer all the questions.
Thanks very much. Maybe during lunch we can have further interactions if members still want more. Let's proceed to a presentation by Dr. Mabinubili from PISA. Those who need tea can go out to grab a cup. Setting up, I'll give you a minute to grab and come back. Is enough to grab and come back.
Thank you.
very much, Chairperson, and honorable members. My name is Jeffrey Mabelebele. I'm the acting CEO of ISA, and I'm not alone today. I'm with Mr. Yo Amo, who is our Chairperson of Matriculation Board, but I'm also with Professor Mudise from UNISA, who is attached currently to UCT on a fellowship program. Yo Amo also, as you know, is a registrar at UCT, but he is today here in his capacity as a Chairperson, Acting Chairperson of the Matriculation Board, and a member of the Admissions Committee of the Board. I should start off by expressing gratitude to you, Chairperson, on behalf of ISA, in whose name I speak today, for the opportunity, and also honorable members also for the opportunity to, for ISA to give this input. Just very briefly, our input revolves around two matters. One is what I would call definitional clarity in terms of the proposed institute, National Institute for Higher Education. But the second issue revolves around what I would call conceptual clarity in terms of the mandate, powers, functions, governance, and other related matters. We are going to be making this input, Chair, mindful of the fact that the provisions in the current amendment do provide for the minister to before establishing a National Institute for Higher Education, to consult with the CHE, and secondly also to publish such a proposed institute in terms of the purpose for which it will be established in the government gazette for others to comment. And we are mindful of that process, and we will definitely, at an appropriate time, interface with such a process. Our submission is very brief, and I'm going to ask Mr. Yo Amo to cited points in terms of what ISA would like to convey to the committee. Thank you very much.
Chairperson and members, thank you very much. I think that the government of what we want to say really is linked to Section 38A and Section 38B as they would be when and if the bill is enacted. We have no quarrel with the suggestions in 38, in the amendment to 38A, which are to make sure that these national institutes have a specific scope or application, and that scope or application is published in the Gazette. Our concern relates to what would come in 38B, and I think, Chairperson, if I could test what comes in 38B against the Minister's announced intention to establish a National Institute for the Humanities. 38B provides for the powers of these national institutes. Now, there could be many types of national institutes, but if we simply look at the envisaged National Institute for the Humanities, we see that 38B provides coordinate the national or regional provision of higher education. Well, a National Institute for the Humanities is not going to provide higher education, so it's not going to coordinate the national or regional provision of higher education. Secondly, the alternative is B, ensure the coherent provision of higher education through program collaboration between national institutes. Well, again, if we have a National Institute for the Humanities, we would assume that that national institute is going to work not just with national institutes, but with the HSRC, which has a mandate in respect of the human sciences, with in respect of all public and private higher education insofar as the humanities are concerned. And then thirdly, advise the Minister on matters relating to the coordination of the provision of higher education. Well, that possibly is what a National Institute for the Humanities could do, but it would be a very limited role for a National Institute of Humanities. I think what this one example suggests is that the envisaged powers under the proposed Section 38 need to be looked at, and that greater clarity needs to be brought to the provisions of 38B if the provision concomitant changes to Section 38B for the powers of those institutes need to be looked at with much more insight in, given the type of institute which they would be. I think we have no concern about the fact that there should be national institutes, or that they should, that the legislation should provide flexibility to enable national institutes to be established. But I think in that context we do need greater clarity about the powers and therefore also the functions of what national institutes would be. Because if these are simply going to be institutions which provide education, well, they are duplicating other existing structures. But if they are going to be new structures which the landscape requires, then we need clarity on their powers and functions. To the second issue, and relates directly to that, the existing provision 38C of the legislation will deal with the governance of these. Now, that's a provision which was enacted for a narrower range of institutions. The composition of the board under 38C was the board contemplated for the previous national institutes in Mpumalanga and the Northern Cape. If one conceives of these national institutes as a very different type of thing, which is what we see the bill as doing, we think that the governance provisions under 38C require attention. The minister is required under 38C simply to publish in the Gazette the manner in which he will receive or she will receive nominations for the board, which is to consist of a chairperson and not more than 10 members. But there is no other provision. Now, for example, if we were looking at the National Institute for Humanities, we would think that in that respect the minister would look at the Academy of South Africa, the Human Sciences Research Council, as bodies that would be interested. But in respect of all higher education institutes, we believe that it would be important and would propose that your committee think about inserting a provision under 38C that those 10 members should include two representatives, say, out of the 10 from public higher education. If these national institutes are going to coordinate the provision as 38B in the as they would be, we think that the higher education sector should be provided, should be represented in the board of the National Institute. So that is our second submission in respect of governance. The next thing that concerns higher education in South Africa concept seems to be much wider than that, and it does seem to us, Chairperson, that a definition in the Act which gave us some understanding of the functions of these would be useful. Chairperson, if I could just comment very briefly on the further amendments that have been tabled this morning in respect of the offices of assessor and administrator. Clearly, higher education has not had an opportunity to reflect on those. Clearly, these are critically important for the sector because they are related not just to the National Institutes but to all public higher education institutions. Some of them I can see straight away. I have had the unfortunate experience of being an assistant to an assessor on a previous occasion, and certainly the provisions relating to assistance to assessors and their powers would have been helpful in those cases. But I think, Chairperson, we would like to be able to make submissions direct to the department about some points of detail in those once we've studied those.
Questions around how they should fund it. My view is that institutions of higher learning should assist government, come with ideas as to how all these things should be done in order to help our people get to where we want them to get to. So I would imagine that HISA is going to advise us as to how where money is going to come from. Thanks.
Chair, I'm happy because you touched the issue of timelines that we have, of which, Chairperson, I believe we cannot be unfair to all the stakeholders and tell them of time if ever there are new things that are being introduced today, of which they still need time to go inside and make the input. But then maybe we cannot finalize it now, Chairperson. We need to talk about this thing and see what is that it is being done. My question, another question, Chair, is on the issue of funding with me also. As to say, when we talk of these institutes, it's not a new thing. They are there. How are they funded right now? Are we saying as well, you are raising the question of funding towards them? What is it that you are saying about the present situation right now? Are we satisfied, or as HISA we are raising this issue of funding, or are you saying from what is already happening now, because they are funded through the state funds, are we saying we are seeing a loophole as to say maybe they will eat more on the money put aside for public investment? I just need us to be open on that one, so that as we move forward, we know exactly as to say, is there anything you see not happening well with the existing ones? If ever we open them for more for them, it's going to impact on the issue of funding towards the universities that are there. But really, I think I will concur with some of the submissions, Chairperson, as to say, maybe even in the bill itself, we need to see more clarity as to say, let us clarify even more what the institutes are for, so that we don't cause the confusion. Because for me, Chairperson, when you go through the submissions that you have been saying, the 16 or 17, you could feel that there is somehow, somewhere, a confusion as to say, what are these institutes we're talking about, these are the universities. So really, maybe if that clarity is well placed in the bill, that should be specialized.
Yes, I'm sure that
the
department is here, to the extent that we may need their input, they will just make an input, because they've got only today and tomorrow to make those inputs in our presence. And if that moment passes, these members are going to formulate that law. And they've got the days I mentioned, and I'm happy that ISA will engage amongst the stakeholders and come back to us to say, on the basis of the proposals emerging from the department, or on the basis of the bill before us, these are some of the aspects that we'd like to clarify from our perspective, and we'll take that into consideration as we engage in our deliberations. I think I seem to say, I may agree with you, so that I'll be concerned that there could be a proliferation of issues, because they must be funded. They would require state support to some extent. And when you deal with legislation, you always engage in that aspect of the financial impact of that legislation, and I hope that exercise have been undertaken by the department, and they have their own analysis, a way of thinking as to how from their side they are going to fund these institutions, and what more advanced is a cautionary intervention as to that funding, because ourselves as Parliament, we may not include a provision here that the National Treasury must set up a budget or a fund for. We don't deal with those aspects. The executive that would like to create the structures must always contemplate structures with an eagle's eye into their financial pot, to say that we have got these resources that are there and we'll be able to fund these sort of institutions. And if they do not have money, we may create legal space for their creation, and they may not create them at all, practically, when they realize that there's no money. Because probably when they establish an institution, they must then go to National Treasury and speak to the Minister of Finance. Would we be able to create a structure? Would we be able to fund it for the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and so on? If not, don't create it. At the legalistic level, myself and Boshoff and the members can contemplate that structure, that the day we've got billions counted in pounds and euros, you can establish them, so that we have free time in Parliament to do constituency work. We will be happy. So we can do that. But I think one key issue that they've raised is clarity as to what is our conceptualization of take twist and turn and it comes everything. And in the end, you find that it swallows the key structures that you have of provisioning of education and all that and all that. So maybe we can need some bit of education from the edifices on that aspect, ourselves as members. So we'll allow that sort of engagement. If the department may want to come at that level, then they will be. Let me allow this moment to his suggestion to amplify.
Chairperson, if I could just add one point on the question of functions. Under Section 38BC, as it will be if the bill is enacted, there could be a national institute which advises the minister on any matter relating to the coordinator of the provision of education. Now, in the act as it stands at the moment, that power is limited to the region in which the national institute is established, because the current legislation deals with that. But if a national institute now is established with this function to advise the minister about the coordination of the provision of higher education, that's actually a duplication of the role of the Council for Higher Education. So that's just another example of why we think that 38B needs to be re-looked to provide clarity. We think, Higher Education South Africa thinks, there may well be a need for legislative provision enabling the minister to establish national institutes. But if there is, we want clarity as to what they are. And I think these examples, and particularly testing the envisaged 38B against the minister's suggestion, which he announced in the budget speech in Parliament earlier this year, that he would be establishing a national institute for the humanities, these powers don't seem to be synchronous with that intention. That national institute, clearly a lot more work has to be done before its detailed nature is understood. But nonetheless, it has been generally supported as something that would advance the cause of the humanities in South Africa. But the functions provided in 38B don't, it seems to us, deal with what's envisaged there. So we're not against the notion of national institutes with a scope of application as determined by the minister, as in the section 38A. It's a question of putting clarity to what that scope is. Chairperson, if I could just address the question of funding. Clearly, you know, any funding for these institutes would be a combination of appropriations from the State Revenue Fund, which Parliament would have to do, and any fees that the beneficiaries of these institutes would have to pay. Our concern is simply that if there were a proliferation of national institutes, this would affect the funding for public higher education. And we know that many of the national public higher education institutions at the moment are really battling financially. We simply are concerned that a proliferation of national institutes, if there's no clarity about their function, might affect the baseline funding of public higher education institutions. That's a concern that he says. It's a parochial concern, yes, but I think we are entitled to express our parochial concerns.
Yeah, we agree. The committee will agree with you on your concern. We may not need many issues, and I'm certain the department might as well be on your side on that aspect. We may not legislate as to how many they may not have at this stage, but if they do so, we can pass legislation. That is the only nice thing about being where we are. We can pass legislation and repeal them, and immediately they'll have to be de-established by the minister. So in case we realize this act is reaching unintended consequences, we'll reconvene here and say, what have we done? What a big mistake. We'll correct that. Are there any further inputs? Can we maybe check
that they have the sources of funding, which has already been provided for in section 28G, which is part of the Act, which provides that it must be money appropriated by Parliament, which makes it subject to the DORA processes, where specific money are earmarked for the universities, and which is dealt with by way of existing policy structures. So it is a mechanism of dividing the cake, because the cake is determined by Parliament according to money available through the Division of Revenue Acts in the year.
Maybe you will tell the Minister that they should not be a portfolio of institutions in the future. So that is what we are saying as we continue on this path. There should not be an avalanche collapsing on South Africa of institutions that will bury public higher education institutions and other institutions which provide education in the country. That is a cautionary message from Parliament and from our stakeholders. Let's proceed to the second presentation.
Sir, before we proceed, just one question for clarity in terms of the process. You indicated that you would welcome our submission. Perhaps we can spell out the timeline, because you have about 2 days tomorrow.
We are having deliberations on this on Friday. We are voting on the bill clause by clause. So on Friday we don't deliberate. We deliberate on Thursday. And our lawyers during that night don't sleep on Thursday. The lawyers don't sleep, I understand so. They refashion the bill in accordance with the agreement of the committee. And then on Friday they submit the final version of the amended bill on which we vote. So Thursday morning we are having deliberations, because yes, what we are saying is, which is very clear, is that by the beginning of Thursday, I'm speaking like a lawyer now, tomorrow I can submit, there's no problem, but at 9 o'clock Thursday, we are beginning deliberation. It's in my attitude, if I meet a document on the door relating to the matter I'm about to debate, given the training which Parliament gave us through practical engagement with issues, we can traverse that document and see whether it helps us or not. So, it's clear I'm taking advice from Hanel that by tomorrow there could be submissions. But from parliamentarians, if they can get those documents, even if they enter at the door, I know that Banga has got academic English skills. He will be able to understand the content of the document. So let's proceed to the presentation of Mr. Mulao from the South African National Apex Cooperative.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. My name is Ntsiye Malao. Can correct the surname is M-A-L-A-O, not M-O. I'm presenting on behalf of South African National Apex Cooperative, SANACO, which is a national organization, is an umbrella organization for cooperatives in this country. So I'm presenting here as a national skills development facilitator for SANACO, endorsed by the board, which the presentation was sent over by our secretary and our chairperson, including other board members. Honorable Chair, as I'm presenting, I would like to request our members also, and the deputy as I here, afterwards I'd engage them so that they come and present some presentation skills to us, because you know we cooperatives, like as I say, I'm a SDF, you know, SDF is a very high position, but one would note that I'm just a graduate from the University of Hard Knocks. You know, I'm still at NQF level 4, but I had to present something at NQF level 8. So, but as I've been around, I know they'll promote me and put me to NQF level 8 in the future. Without any waste of time on my presentation, noting the time is gone, but I just go to the background of South African National Apex Cooperative. The SANACO, as the umbrella organization, was formulated in 2008, where the DTI invited all provinces to send representatives in what we call Tshwane Showground. And fortunately, I was part of the delegation from the Northwest. I'm coming from Northwest in a rural community called Makapanstad, under Chief Makapan. So I'm inside. So we're part of those delegates, and I was fortunate also to be elected when DTI gave us a guidance that each province should have three delegates, what we call an interim body by then. Then the interim, the three guys from each province at the end formulated SANACO, which was launched on the 1st of October 2009. Then we have the birth of SANACO. So SANACO at the moment, Honorable Chair, is in all provinces. It has membership in all provinces. It has membership in all sectors. We have 10 sectors within the cooperatives in this country. We are represented in all sectors. In terms of our submission, Honorable Chair, with regard to Further Education and Training Colleges Amendment Bill B24, I think for those who might not be aware, the presentation is still inside, is in this submission in the middle for those who didn't have a separate presentation from us. Honorable Chair, I'll just run through, I won't be reading all what we presented, but I'll just summarize the idea coming from SANACO. I think we need to acknowledge and appreciate SANACO now is member of the International Cooperative Alliance, which is an international movement, is the umbrella body of all countries. We accepted last year in Mexico within the Congress of All Cooperative of ICA. And also I must mention that next year we'll be hosting the special assembly here in South Africa, and of course for the first time in the whole continent, since the birth of ICA in the 18th. So we need to pride as a crown tree. We need also to look the milestone, the achievement coming with SANACO. On the bill, we are saying we, as SANACO, we want to be involved in the FET college development, especially we are saying as SANACO, we want to see a cooperative college or a cooperative academy that would help to develop cooperatives. I think our colleagues from SAWICO have already mentioned the numbers, which they said is about member minimum to have one in one COP, there should be a minimum of 5. But at the moment when I'm looking, we've been piloting something in Limpopo where one co-op is serving 1,071 members. I think the number is very huge. If you take those numbers with an average of 10, it gives you certain figures. But the most important that we need to know is that cooperatives are taking poor of the poor within that. So when we talk the FET band levels, the majority of our members at the moment, I can say almost 60%, are not even at the level of FET. The majority of our members are within the GETC. As said by Sawiko, we acknowledge that the GETC band level is meant for basic education. But we are saying if we have a cooperative academy at the level of an FET, I think it would help our rural poor women with a disability sitting mobility, because at the moment what said also is that the compliance rate within our cooperatives is very low. As I said, since January, I'm dealing with Limpopo, we are piloting taxi cooperative. We are dealing with 6 regional taxi cooperatives. But when we look at the rate of understanding around the cooperative compliance, I think it leaves much to be desired. So we are saying with this bill, Honorable Chair, consider having a cooperative academy where we would include our mothers and fathers. As you know, in rural areas, the cooperative concept has been there even during Act 91 of 1981. Cooperatives, agriculture, cooperatives, they've been there. And these are the people with large flock of heads of cattle, including large scale of plowing fields, but not educated. I mean, the current system of farming have been developed much, but our mothers and our fathers have been using the old method. So we need to recognize that, as said by our colleague, in terms of recognition of prior learning, the RPL process. We need to take these people and put them maybe in the FET band level. But we are saying if this portfolio committee and the department could consider setting up an academy that would help our own people how to manage the cooperative, how to comply, how to run their annual general meeting in line with Act 14 of 2005, I think we'll make a huge stride. The reason that we are not complying at the moment with the legislation, Act 14 of 2005, is the mere reason that the literacy level is not something that we could see our rural poor functioning very well. And we think with this committee engaging them further with SANACO, maybe they would consider that we have a specialized FET college that would mean to educate our rural poor. And of course, having footing in all provinces, we'd like to see dedicated FET college or a cooperative academy in each province where we would see our people getting education around development of cooperatives. You'd know the Honorable Chair, within Africa, Kenyans and Tanzanians are leading in terms of developing cooperatives. But one would know that Tanzania is running a 4-year cooperative management and governance training where you would graduate with a degree. So I've been contemplating some of the CITAS. I thought maybe they'll sponsor me to go to Tanzania. So through you, Chair, I know you command respect from the CITAS. Maybe coming there, we'd see some of us going to Tanzania, because I mean, we need that. At the moment, South Africa developed as it is, we don't have anything specific. We don't have a learning program for cooperatives. But if you look, we have had Act 91 of 1981. We have had Act 14 of 2005. don't have any learning program around cooperative. I think within the SADC region, is looking South Africa to lead, but at the moment we cannot lead. We cannot lead in terms of education. I think we, with the SAPA and other acts, yes, we are advanced. Higher education, we are advanced. I mean, we are the first world country in terms of performance of education, but the very same education that should help the very poor people which are within the cooperative, we are doing anything there at the moment. So I'll say through you, Chair, maybe this needs to be given a speedy attention that it deserves, that as we amend this bill, we incorporate cooperative academy. We would see our people could undergo. Because the idea is to copy the concept which is in Kenya. In Kenya, before they register a co-op, it would undergo a training program, maybe a week or so. And after they say, are you still interested to register a co-op? And people say, no, it's a difficult process. We don't want to be a co-op. Or no. Because in Kenya, when they issue a certificate, you become effective immediately. But in this country, the majority of our co-op, they just register and they sit there. They are not compliant. Most have been deregistered. Because I'm aware, as a family doing other basic co-op, I think in Karsiban, there's a co-op which has been more than 100,000 in the bank account is deregistered. For the main reason, it could not comply with the act. This is the reality. You can think how many other have been deregistered by TTI because they don't comply. But they are functional. The reason that they are functional. This agricultural home, our mothers, poor, illiterate mothers are producing meal, maybe they are producing cattle, but their home will be deregistered because they don't know anything about company. So if we can have a cooperative academy, Honorable Chair, I think it will make a great difference. As I say, noting your time, Honorable Chair, that's basically what I want to present on behalf of the mother body of cooperatives in this country, SANACO. I thank you.
Well, thank you for your presentation. I like it because there's even Hisa here. And in higher education, there should be vast literature on cooperatives, which we can tap from as we go on to engage with and see how it is structured in a manner that the levels of literacy of South Africans is able to articulate and relate to that literature. There must be a lot of literature around cooperatives and how we could improve them. And I think what teach that we are raising is about whether we need a special college for cooperatives or we need South Africans to begin to develop some educational program for cooperatives in various colleges that could be offered to address this aspect, and I think we need to look at that, and the department is here, they'll be able to take that home and see how they will work very closely with your institution. Our department has got the responsibility to work with cooperatives, and I'm certain that we'll engage with you and see how ultimately we can sharpen the path of engagement. And then also ensuring that in the end we have a broad educational program mix that also caters for this area, because we hear that there are many cooperatives that are experiencing deregistration on the basis of non-compliance with the legislative framework, and then that must be a very serious challenge that
maybe just on a note of clarity, the Cooperative Act obviously is a very old act, and it was established long ago to really look at big big businesses to sort of support mostly in the agricultural sector, but also in other sectors, to work for farmers and other people to work together in the production line. And the amendments that was made in Act 14 of 2005 was actually to create two different type of cooperatives. And the one that we're referring to at the moment is the basic one where there's only a few members that is forming a cooperative for specific reasons, and that is for small-scale producers, whether it is agriculture or any other product, to get their product into the markets and to establish a sort of a close relation to cut costs and to run that type of thing. So the basic need, and I think that is my question to the presenter, is that they actually need training on economic management and production management. And I think that's a specific need that can be also included in the former presentation that was made by the women people. That is actually similar to this basic need that is needed. Now, in the existing field of training that we have, I believe it should be looked in, where do they fit in? Do we need an extra situation where they can be specifically trained in these issues that is needed to capacitate them to do that? Or can they fit into other institutions, like the FET colleges, or whatever the case may be? Because I believe that there are many overlapping training facilities that can produce the sort of information and training that is needed to capacitate these people. We must just remember that the support that they need on the training side is different to the support that they need on long-term maintenance of their structures. That is a thing that is internally orientated. So that is my just for maybe for what it's worth. Thank you, Chair. Sorry, maybe I could just add this, Chair. I think also there is an existing, and it was also existed from the start, on the cooperative side, the big cooperatives have an organization. They do support their organization people. They were all obviously called the Cooperative South African Cooperative Organization, but they've changed their name to the Agricultural Business Chamber. That includes all sorts of cooperatives and businesses in the agricultural sector, but it can be expanded. And they do training. They've got a lot of facilities that they support their people from. Just for information that we must look at what is really needed in this situation.
It's helpful.
The number, the list, there's this number 19, which says the fact that Sanaco R, is it L? Is it supposed to be Sanaco L? On 19.
I think it should be Sanaco FN, Apex Body.
FN?
Yeah, I think so. But as I say, he says he can correct us. We have reliable people.
Sanaco. According to the top six here, is four males and two females. I'm talking about gender balance now. How big are they? How far do they stretch in their executive? They still want to check the gender balance if it's 50-50.
The people are stretching their limit now. They want to know how you are structured.
question from the honourable member in terms of the comments and the question where he mentioned that the department had to work with cooperatives also to develop co-ops, and also mentioning that the co-op act seemed to be very old. Well, honourable member, I think for us at 14 of 2005, as I said, it's already been amended. I think that new edition that would make the cooperative viable in terms of the act. But I also agree with honourable member that we as co-ops, we need more around economic management and production management training, which is true. As I've just said a bit, that if you look within the taxi co-ops, I'll say this because this is the present program that we are closing tomorrow. We've been training these taxi co-ops in terms of compliance. It's true, in terms of economic management, that is a lot that needs to be done. We have tried to embrace the co-op act and a little bit of how the treasurer had to maintain narrative reports, financial reports, keeping vouchers. At the moment, mostly are not non-existent. To the extent where you find a taxi co-op have a register, they have a bank account, but they still spend their money in a taxi association, which is a non-registered entity. So you start thinking compliance part. That's in a way, we have 60,000 taxi, we've made profit, but where is it? It's in the taxi association, and the 60,000 is done by a taxi cooperative. So there's a lot that need to do. That is true, we need to do a lot in terms of economic management, and of course the production management. How do they manage their taxis and other than there's a lot that need. I think the question that does it fit in the FET college, to a certain extent, yes, it does. But as an advocacy and lobbying organization, we say we want to copy Botswana. I think in July they've launched their cooperative academy. Lesotho, I think, is waiting to, might not be updated. They might have launched one at the moment. But as I say, at the moment, we are led by Kenya and Tanzania. What the concept that we want to see happening in South Africa, we want to have a specialized college that would deal with cooperatives only. That's our wish, that in Ongron we have this. Besides that, yes, in far-flung areas, the so-called rural FET college could still put these programs within the far-flung rural FET colleges to help, because as the numbers are very huge, and a specialized college, only one FET college in the Eastern Cape, you can imagine the impact can make. I mean, KZN is leading with registration of cooperatives. Up to now, it's taking almost 80% of all registered co-ops in this country. So imagine having one FET co-op academy in KZN. That would not make an impact, but you can also fit within other FET colleges in the country. But our wish is that let's have the main supplier, the main co-op FET or co-op should be in each province. In terms of gender balance, it's true when you look the executive board, and it's true, as Awuto has said, the majority of members in SANAC are women. That's a fact. The majority of our members are women. You go to our events, the people who chant song are women. If you have said if you have seen the international co-op day that we held in Kimberley recently, when you go to the store, the majority of people who are exhibiting are women. The people who are raising issues are women. So one of my members is true, but when you look our board, it doesn't reflect that. But I must mention also the deputy president, Mr. Sam Rapport, who is showing, just replaced a woman. There's a woman who has left that position. It was a position for a woman, but when they feel there was no one coming forward for, as you know when you elect board member. is pushing us to say, everywhere we go, they reflect and say, are you saying the majority of members are women, with only two men sitting in the top echelons of this organization? But Mama would be very excited that finances is in a woman's hands, you know. The purse, they always say, the man with the purse decides the agenda. That's one quote I learned from Matrix. The man with the purse decides the agenda. So meaning, in Sanaco, the only person who can decide the agenda is a woman. In this case, I think Mama, that would excite you. No wrong doing around that. I think that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. chair of the Adult Learning Network. Oh, yes, go ahead, please. You can say something and then we'll...
Thank you, Chair. As you have said, maybe we'll engage during lunch. I must say, I must apologize that they'll only collect us at 1:30 for our flight, so we have to go back, I know. So the only thing that interests me, it means I'll eat first, even before you, Chairperson.
Okay, let's go to the other center. It was a very inspiring presentation. Today is a lively engagement here in the hub. We think when we're saying he sides here, we will allow the school that left earlier on. They've got various programs, academic English, they've got industrial English, they might as well have an aspect on the cooperative English. So that
my name is Archie Mokonani. I'm the chairperson of the Adult Learning Network. Maybe before I continue with my presentation, I would like to convey our thanks and gratitude for the time that you spent with us in our national conference last week. We appreciated that very much, because since the inception of the minister and yourselves, the only people who have met is the CETAS, the colleges, higher ed, and we were worried that the adult learning or adult education sector, that once more we are children of the department. The Adult Learning Network was established in 2002, and before the Adult Learning Network, we had an association called ITASA, Adult Educators and Trainers Association of South Africa, which closed down because there was a withdrawal of sponsors. We then started this Adult Learning Network. The Adult Learning Network is a network which composed of NGOs, CBOs that are engaged in adult education, and we also have members from the public adult learning centers in the country, and they are members of the Adult Learning Network. So in 2002, when we were established, the mandate that we were given is to collaborate with civil society organizations, trade unions, and all other stakeholders to strengthen the adult education sector, and also to engage government, to engage business, and activities that we are actually involved in is advocacy, where the ALN lobbies government, business, and potential funders and international donors to generate support for our sector. So we also, every year or annually, celebrate Adult Learner Week, which takes place in the first week of September. As we were celebrating the last week and having the conference, Chairperson, the Adult Learning Network has noted the publication, and we support the tabling and the enactment of this bill. The Adult Learning Network acknowledges and supports the promulgation of the aforementioned legislation, as they are perceived to promote the long envisaged identity of the adult education sector, which over the years has been inundated by the cut, copy and paste approach from the mainstream, which has proved to be a big disaster. Adult education is the most disadvantaged sector in terms of funding, such that it is a shame that in 2012 this sector has not finalized the institutionalization of its operational systems like recruitment, conditions of service, infrastructure, which is relevant and responsive to learner qualifications, and those who are not defined the relevant educator qualification within the promulgated higher education and qualifications framework. And more institutions of higher learning have either scaled down on the provision of adult educator qualifications or totally shut them down. This is evident in the way the sector is so unstable in terms of educator attrition rates. There is also a low learner intake in basic levels and in the basic levels, and generally low learner performance with high dropout rate. So today, nationally, the performance of the sector continues to be under 40%. The introduction of these pieces of legislation begins to resuscitate the long-lost hope in the sector, which has the potential for social change and stability. In a country that has the highest unemployment rate, adult education sector continues to provide a safe landing by becoming a catchment area for the out-of-school youth and unemployed adults. It is not a debate that South Africans have lost their ground in the microeconomy sector. This sector has the potential to contribute to the reduction of higher unemployment rate by the provision of skills in the microeconomy. These sectors include hair care, domestic workers, garden services, car guards, general building and maintenance, motor body repairs, that is just to name a few. If the vision of skills development initially positioned adult education sector as the cornerstone for the acceleration of skilling the unemployed workforce, the situation would be much better. The reason for this statement is that adult education was neglected in the institutional landscape. People suffered in local communities to have access to education and training, as the favored institutions were out of reach. Skills development continued to benefit mainly the private providers and became milking cow to benefit the few, whilst communities suffered lack of skills needed for employment and SMME development. Community education and training concept. On this one, Chairperson, the ALN really applauds the dawning of the paradigm shift to adult education. The bill repeals the concept of IET as encapsulated in IET Act 52 of 2000 and replaces it with community education and training. The fact that we are moving to the concept community college has huge implications for our sector. The right to adult basic education, the Constitution entrenches the right to adult basic education. The changes proposed by the Further Education and Training Amendment Bill 2012 means that the proposed institution, the Community Education and Training Colleges, will be under an amended FET Colleges Act. What are the implications of the right to adult, adult basic education in the amendment legislation? Does it mean that the right to adult basic education is no longer legislated? Those are the questions we are asking on the right to adult basic education. Chairperson, standalone infrastructure, we're saying almost in all provinces, many IX centers are still operating as night schools, having to wait for schools to be out before the facilities can be used for adult education and training. Despite that, the demographic profile of the sector has evolved over the years, where we see more younger learners who are available during the day, and the night schooling system has continued. The proposal for community education and training centers to operate within the FET colleges or assessing underutilized schools would continue to undermine the sector. If there are no mechanisms legislated to ensure that underutilized infrastructure is accessed by CETCs. Also, there should be clear guidelines and prescriptions which define the physical structure of a CETC so that we do not find ourselves in the same predicament where citizens continue to shy away due to the infrastructure that undermines their human rights to dignity. And then on policy, but then policy shift, higher education and training policies are driven under the banner of andragogy. The currently prevailing instructional approach in this sector is that of mainstream education, which has totally suffocated the innovation and creativity in adult education. All post-school institutions must be accredited to provide own qualifications based on their own research and needs. The prevailing norm is currently disempowering as educators are relying on the spoon-feeding approach. The concept college implies that educators are the driving engines of curriculum design and subject specialists in the related field. There is long work in changing this mindset, and mechanisms should be entrenched in the educator lecture development approach, which would totally mirror that of the university standard. Chairperson, this means the instructional approach should be geared to acceleration of learning using various learning methodologies which are flexible to adult learning. If the aim is to build strong, empowered communities, policy shift should result to paradigm shift, hence educator qualifications should be taken to serious consideration. This will have implications on the type of conditions of service and research by the sector. And the governance and management, we're saying this area is currently the weakest link. But under the CETCs, these areas will be strengthened and ensure that there is stability and promote the quality of education and training. Communities will have stronger voices and they will play important roles in their own development. And then the National Institute for Higher Education, this structure is a very important forum in that it will provide professional guidance and research in the higher ed. There is a need for a seamless approach and operation, especially in the area of NQF. It is still a challenge to have upward or sideways mobility in terms of learning credits accumulation. Many people are unemployable due to that. They cannot be able to produce a national certificate from their loose qualification. RPL is not yet working. This structure must really create an enabling environment for CETCs to thrive, and this is the sector which is in dire need for research. And I said this in our conference last week, that the RPL is only accessible to those who have already taken up lifelong learning. But for those who are still to decide or want to, RPL is not accessible to them. So we need to ensure that we begin the implementation, because all the time it's discussions, task teams on RPL. Then the implementation plan, the ALN would request the portfolio committee to call for a clear implementation plan from the Department of Higher Education and Training once the FET Colleges Amendment Bill 2012 is promulgated by Parliament. This would
afford the sector clear direction on the implementation of the proposed changes. And lastly, Chair, on the cooperative governance, the Adult Learning Network would also propose that cooperation be institutionalized with adult education and training stakeholders in both the FET and the INX. Both were proposed as mechanisms for stakeholder participation and engagement with the department. I know that there was what we called Nababet. That board never took off from the ground. And now we're moving on to the amendment. So our plea would be we should ensure that those boards which are being proposed, they actually happen. Such structures are no longer functioning, as I said, and they are no longer in existence. So it is hoped that the ministry will provide clarity on this matter once the proposed white paper is put out for public engagement. All in all, Chairperson, as the ALN, we support the bill.
Thank you very much. I think what is very clear is that the adult network is highlighting the aspect that the provision of adult education is constitutional imperative, and that it should not be lost in how we continue to conceptualize the programs to be offered in community education and training colleges. And I think that is kind of a very important point which they are articulating, and they do support the researched community education and training colleges, and would like to ensure that there are special qualifications for educators in this sector appropriate meeting where they'll adopt a final position.